Hello, and welcome to our program, The Saturday Evening Post, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Dick Holt, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from The Saturday Evening Post here on Owl Radio. To be honest, I didn't know The Saturday Evening Post existed. If I knew it, if I read it in the last 50 years, I would be surprised. In any event, I'll pick a few articles from it. It's a pretty long magazine, so this will be my best effort to get the essence of it. Starting off with A Lighter Side by Philip Gully, Think Before Building. It's sobering to realize how much work goes into the simplest construction project. Last spring, just as lumber prices were soaring into the stratosphere, I had the bright idea to build a screen house at our farm, a cool place to sit and read and contemplate our green valley. I phoned my friend Ross Hutchison, who 10 years before had renovated the farmhouse my wife's grandfather had begun in 1913. When Ross isn't building million-dollar mansions north of Indianapolis, he lives in a log cabin 100 miles south of the city, over the ridge and through the woods from our farmhouse, and can sometimes be coaxed into abandoning the millionaires for a week or two to build something for me. We met the next Saturday at the farm, and I drew, in broad, ambiguous strokes, the kind of screen house I wanted, trusting Ross would not only fill in the blanks, but improve the design. My drawing looked like something first graders might sketch when told by their teacher to draw a house. The only thing missing was the chimney, the puff of smoke, and the sun in the upper right-hand corner. Ross advised me to wait until lumber prices eased, but I, for the first time in our years of association, had a clever idea he hadn't thought of first. "Let's buy raw lumber from Mike Lowe's sawmill," I said. "It's a lot cheaper. Then we'll let it dry in my barn and start building in early fall." I'm being overly generous with the pronoun we, since Ross and his crew did all the work, but I wanted Ross to feel he could count on my assistance. The next week, I ordered the lumber from the sawmill, and 2 weeks after that, Mike Lowe phoned to tell me the lumber was cut. So I asked my neighbor Jeff Lindley if he might drive his truck and trailer to the sawmill to retrieve the lumber. His father Jack met us at the farm to offload the lumber with his tractor, and I stacked it in the barn, a thoroughly unpleasant task until my friend Dave Helton stopped past and I talked into helping by promising to assist him if he ever built a screen house. Thankfully, Dave has a poor memory and soon forgot my promise. Summer dwindled into autumn, the lumber shed its moisture, and Ross and his crew arrived on a Wednesday morning in late September to set the posts. After identifying the ideal location, 20 feet from the back porch, near enough a maple tree to eventually enjoy its shade, but not so close to be caved in should it fall. What seemed like stacking in the barn to be a colossal amount of lumber proved to be insufficient for the task, so more lumber was ordered. Jeff Lindley and his trailer were once again summoned, and this time my wife helped me stack the wood to dry. Ross returned in mid-December to finish the job, except for the screened windows, which I will build this spring, just in time for screenhouse season. After that, there'll be river rock to spread under the screenhouse to keep the weeds in check, rose bushes to plant at the corners, and 2 coats of stain to protect the wood. If all goes according to my plan, my wife will do that. It's sobering to realize all the work that goes into the construction of a simple 12-by-16 screenhouse. Even writing about it is somewhat wearying, so I will likely be spending a great deal of the spring and summer in my screenhouse, catching my breath. The author, Philip Gully, is a Quaker pastor and author of 22 books, including Harmony and Hope, featuring Sam Garner. And that was his article, Think Before Building. I'll continue now with a feature called Contrarywise, labeled Our Favorite Curmudgeons Take Aim at Sacred Cows, Addicted to Novelty. There's a lot of hype and propaganda these days about how progress and change are such positive forces for mankind. The COVID vaccine was invented and disseminated in record time, saving millions of lives. And books and pundits are celebrating humanity's triumphant march into the future. I don't win any popularity contests with friends or on Facebook when I not so respectfully dissent from all this optimism. The common response is, there he goes again, always being negative. In fact, to me, the only positive thing about most of these comments is that someone will occasionally use the word curmudgeon as a term of ignominy, a description I actually love. But I believe that many of those who celebrate the positive things in life know they're just lying to themselves and trying to bury their fears about the future and their terror at growing old under a cloak of false optimism. Change is good is a mantra that is drummed into us, often by those whose real definition of change is the kind that rings merrily in the cash register. But if we're being honest, who actually feels anything but a shard of dread each time upgrade necessary flashes on the computer? It's no surprise that last year's incredibly dangerous SolarWinds software hack, probably a Russian attack on some of our most sensitive computer systems, was embedded in one of these routine upgrades. Yes, progress has brought us many good things, but do we need to get them every week? Our great-great-grandparents were happy for decades to enjoy music in the concert hall or at home on the piano. Then the gramophone was invented, and for many years afterward, people thrilled to those big, heavy 78 RPM records. Then around 1950, the 33 and a third record displaced these, along with those little 45s we loved to stack on the record player. Some 30 years later, cassettes and then CDs took their place. But in the 21st century, new innovations spring forth almost every year. We can now stream music at will from phones, computers, and shower stalls. And we can order it up by shouting at Siri or Alexa, getting any music, anytime, anywhere. Isn't that something to be celebrated? I'd say no. What used to be special has now become less than ordinary. It used to be an occasion to buy a new record, just holding it in our hands, perusing the cover and jacket copy. All of this is just a distant memory to those of us who are actually lucky to remember it. And if you do remember it, don't you miss the excitement, the specialness of those experiences? Streaming new sounds on Spotify constantly is no replacement. Of course, there are truly positive and enchanting novelties to discover. I certainly love to try different foods, if they are genuine cuisines and not some concoction of a celebrity chef attempting to trend on Twitter. And I'm happy to say yes to reading some new books and meeting some new people. But there's so much more richness in exploring what we already have, in learning more about those places that are already part of our lives, instead of endlessly jumping into those depressing airplanes to take us to disparate and foreign places to check off our bucket lists. One of the more amusing aspects of our addiction to novelty is that the past keeps getting recycled as what was boring and passé one minute becomes retro and exciting the next. Are people actually rediscovering the joys and innovations of the 90s? The 90s? I'm sorry, but the charm and the excitement of this increasingly dizzying merry-go-round escaped me, and I'm happy to jump off. I would happily adopt Nancy Reagan's anti-drug motto, just say no. But since I'm a curmudgeon in the face of the 21st century's cornucopia of newness, I'll settle for Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener's response, I would prefer not to. And that was by Peter Block, who wrote Addicted to Novelty. From the Fun with Food section, Raspberry Rhubarb Smoothie. Bright red rhubarb stalks are one of the first fruits or vegetables of spring. Don't just use the leaves, they're poisonous. My recipe for raspberry rhubarb smoothies with blueberries is as pretty as it is delicious, says food blogger and cookbook author Tegan Gerard, halfbakedharvest.com. This makes four. For a simple syrup, 4 stalks rhubarb chopped, 1 1/3 cup sugar, 2 cups water, 1 sprig fresh mint chopped. For smoothies, 1/3 cup rhubarb simple syrup, 12 ounces raspberries, fresh or thawed, plus more for garnishing, 1 cup frozen blueberries, divided, 16 ounces sparkling water or Prosecco, chilled, 6 ounces fresh blueberries, wood skewers, and fresh mint for garnish. To make the syrup, in a medium saucepan, combine rhubarb, sugar, and water. Boil over medium-high heat about 10 minutes, stirring occasionally until rhubarb breaks down. Remove from heat, add mint, and let sit 1 minute. Pour mixture through fine mesh strainer. Note, if the mixture is too watery, return to the pot and cook until mixture is slightly reduced. Cover and refrigerate until cold, about 1 hour. To make the smoothies, in a blender, blend 12 ounces raspberries and 1/3 cup rhubarb simple syrup until completely smooth. Divide frozen blueberries among 4 glasses. Skewer the fresh blueberries on wood skewers. Divide raspberry rhubarb mixture among the glasses. Top off with sparkling water, Prosecco, or other sparkling wine. Add blueberries, stick, and swirl to mix. Garnish with raspberries and mint and serve. And that was from Fun with Food, Raspberry Rhubarb Smoothie. Jordan, Two Brothers of the South. Shortly after graduating from Yale Law School in 1973 at the age of 27, Bill Clinton took out a pen and piece of paper and wrote down his most important life goals. I want to be a good man, have a good marriage and children, have good friends, make a successful political life, and write a great book. Assessing how he fared decades later against those 5 missions, he was unequivocal with respect to the 3rd. No person I know ever had more or better friends. Although he would call upon many of those friends, one man in particular gave him the emotional life he most needed when he became the youngest ex-governor in American history. In 1980, the voters of Arkansas rejected Clinton's bid for re-election to the office he loved. He was only 34. His vision of a grand political career, which so many others believed would carry him to the White House, now appeared to be in tatters. He became depressed, convinced his career was over. Even before the polls opened in November 1980, Clinton knew that 2 of his own decisions had imperiled his re-election bid. A steep new license tax he enacted that enraged every car and truck owner in the state, and his reluctance acquiescent to President Jimmy Carter's decision to transfer Cuban refugees from the Mariel boat lift into northwest Arkansas. Nightly television reports led with the ensuing rioting and lawlessness, further alienating voters. 10 minutes after the polls closed, Clinton knew his tenure was over. In the early weeks after his defeat, Clinton tried to make sense of how everything had come undone so quickly. In dozens of calls to friends and acquaintances, he heard plenty of support and commiseration. But that didn't change his view. His perfect career had been knocked off its trajectory. This time he felt too depressed to chart a comeback. Vernon Jordan had watched the returns from his 5th Avenue apartment in New York City on election night 1980. Ronald Reagan and his conservative Republican coalition swept the nation, winning the White House, flipping the Senate, and ushering in a generational realignment of American politics. Jordan was one of the nation's most prominent civil rights leaders, and he was concerned what that rightward shift would mean for the future of a movement to which he had dedicated much of his life. Amid all the carnage, one race in particular saddened him, the defeat of Bill Clinton in Arkansas. The two men had met only 3 years earlier at a banquet for the National Urban League in Little Rock. Clinton then was a state attorney general, and Jordan was in town to raise funds for the powerful civil rights organization he had led for nearly a decade. Jordan had known of Clinton for years through Hillary, whom he met in 1969, minutes after Hillary had given a speech at an activist conference in Colorado. She was sitting on a park bench going over the rest of the day's schedule with Peter Edelman, a former Robert Kennedy aide, when into my high side came a pair of highly polished shoes and a voice that said, "Well, Peter, aren't you going to introduce me to this earnest young woman?" Hillary remembered, "I looked all the way up from his shoes up to the head of this very attractive man. We started talking, and instantly I was struck by his intelligence, his charisma and mannerisms. Just an incredible public presence. From that day forward, we stayed in touch with each other until I introduced him to Bill years later. It was a mind meld between them from the get-go." 43 years later, Bill Clinton vividly recalled the first time the two met. The Urban League banquet was in a big school setting inside a big gymnasium. We had a heck of a crowd there, and he was a big star. The MC for the evening was this woman who was one of our best TV anchors. She wore a beautiful dress that was high-collared but had no back. Vernon and I were sitting on either side of the lectern where she was speaking, and her back was visible to Vernon. And he said to me after we were walking out, he said, "She's a very attractive lady, and that was a beautiful dress. It's too bad they ran out of fabric before they finished it." And so began Bill Clinton's closest adult friendship, fittingly, in laughter and not surprisingly, about women, which would become a frequent topic of conversation. Over time, the bond would play a pivotal role at the most important moments of Clinton's political and personal lives. When he thought about quitting politics, Jordan talked him out of it. A decade later, when he considered running for president, Jordan told him he was ready. Once in office, Clinton only had to say, "Get Vernon," and Vernon would appear, asking for nothing in return. And then, when a sex scandal nearly ended Clinton's presidency, Jordan was there to save his marriage and bolster his defense. That single exchange back in 1977 presaged thousands of conversations and asides, some serious, others better left for the locker room, that would keep Clinton and Jordan engaged and entertained for the next 4 decades. Their banter would play out at Thanksgiving at Camp David and during Christmas Eve parties at the Jordan's D.C. home, on Martha's Vineyard for summer vacations, and on golf courses across the country, in the Oval Office and upstairs in the White House residence. As one former aide said, they complemented each other perfectly. Both were extremely smart and charismatic. Both were larger-than-life guys with big appetites to do big and important things in life. Both Clinton and Jordan became transformational forces in their fight for racial equality. Clinton through sweeping reforms in the Arkansas legislature, Jordan through his legal and voter registration efforts in his native Georgia. Both men then made their mark on the national stage. Clinton as a progressive Southerner, Jordan as a moderate bridge builder to the white community. Their shared commitment to racial equality was what initially united them. But the easy rapport and love of the game, especially politics and sports, took the Clinton-Jordan friendship to another level. The person who witnessed the friendship the most, Hillary Clinton, said that Jordan intuitively understood what Bill and any president needs, someone they can just totally relax with, tell stories with, share a joke with, someone to just go out on the golf course with and not talk about anything of any significance if that's what they choose. That's what I thought was the incredible gift Vernon gave us over all the years we've known him. Both of them were operators, players. They knew how much each of them had benefited from their boundless charm and confident bearing. At 6'2" and 6'5", with broad shoulders and radiant smiles, Clinton and Jordan were keenly aware how much they lit up whatever room they occupied. When they turned those powers on each other the first night they met, the chemistry was electric. When Clinton later used that same magnetism on an intern in the White House, the effect would be equally electric, but with devastating consequences. By the time he dialed his defeated friend in December 1980, Jordan knew the soon-to-be ex-governor needed a stern talking to. Hillary answered the phone to a booming baritone of a voice. It was Vernon. "You got any grits down there?" Jordan asked. "I don't know how to make grits, but you come on down," Hillary told him. A few weeks later, Jordan stood in the tiny kitchen of Clinton's small yellow-framed house where they had just moved in after vacating the governor's mansion. Awaiting him was a piping hot plate of instant grits Hillary had purchased that morning. When he entered the cramped kitchen in his tailored three-piece suit and saw the young couple with their one-year-old daughter, Chelsea, Jordan could feel their despondence, especially from the ex-governor. Gone was the confidence and verve that had so enchanted and impressed Jordan at their first meeting. He now saw sitting before him a diminished man carrying an overwhelming, if irrational, sense of rejection. Worse, he seemed lost, searching for direction but lacking will or a compass to steer himself. Over the next 2.5 hours, Vernon Jordan's regal presence dominated the small room. If ever there was a moment for Jordan to show his stuff, it was in that kitchen at that table as Bill Clinton wrestled with what to do next. Jordan knew he needed some straight talking, so he gave it to him in blunt, direct terms. "Stop pitying yourself and appreciate what others see in you. You're a man of immense promise who suffered a single setback, not a career-ending defeat. You have too much talent, too much commitment to the causes you care about, too much support to step off the stage and give it all up." He knew that I had just become the youngest former governor in the history of the country and that my epitaph had been written, Bill Clinton recalled. He told me, "You and Hillary, you got a lot of talent and your heart's in the right place. It's going to come out all right." Nobody else was saying that to me, Clinton remembered 40 years later. That wasn't the storyline. Jordan's message resonated with Clinton at the very moment when he was seriously beginning to entertain offer out of state that would have given him better financial security and less heartache. "He told me I needed to stay in the game," Clinton said. By this point, Clinton had been approached about becoming the head of the World Wildlife Federation, chief of staff to Governor Jerry Brown of California, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, or president of the University of Louisville. Then Jordan appeared as a lone voice in the wilderness. "You're not done, and you shouldn't think you're done," Hillary remembered Jordan saying as Bill ticked off the opportunities he was considering. He made a big impression on him in that moment. Eventually, his message sank in. "I just took a deep breath, and instead of being miserable, after that, it all began to sort of fall into place, and I began to just think about the rest of my life and try to live in the present and for the future." That conversation was a milestone in Bill's decision to stay in Arkansas, stay in politics, and ultimately to run for president, Hillary said. Before leaving for the Little Rock Airport, Jordan offered one more piece of advice for friend Hillary Rodham. She needed to start using Clinton as her last name. If Bill was going to make a political comeback someday, as he hoped to do it in Arkansas, Hillary needed to accede to the conventions of the time and tone down her feminist rhetoric. As Bill recalled, Vernon said to her, "I'm older than you are. I think keeping the last name is bothering a lot of older black people, and we need them all." And Hillary thought if Vernon believed she could do it and maintain her integrity and be who she was, it made her think she could do it. Hillary agreed. It was important to have his voice in that decision. "I respected his intelligence and political experience and really paid attention to what he told me." On the heels of that pivotal conversation, Clinton went back to the voters of Arkansas, asking for their forgiveness and for another chance. 2 years later, on January 11, 1983, Bill Clinton, with Hillary Rodham Clinton by his side, took the oath of office as the 42nd governor of Arkansas. Amid the sea of thousands of onlookers massed at the front of Capitol to see Clinton restored to power as the state's favored son was a smiling Vernon Jordan. The author, Gary Ginsberg, has spent his professional career at the intersection of media, politics, and law. He worked for the Clinton administration, was senior editor and counsel at the magazine George, and has published pieces in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And he wrote, here are a few articles from the Your Health section, the medical mailbox by Wendy Braun, registered nurse. Stretch away hip pain. My hips feel tight and sore when I stand up. Is it serious? She answers, probably not, and you're in good company. There's been a general uptick in muscular hip discomfort during the pandemic, according to Pittsburgh-based double board certified physical therapist Keelan Ensecki. The most common cause of pain when you first come to a standing from a seated position is tight hip flexors due to prolonged sitting, says the therapist. Americans across the board are at risk of the common problem and will benefit from stretching super tight muscles in the front of the upper leg, he continues. Here's how. First, stand more. Set a timer to change position or walk around for a bit every 30 to 60 minutes. Find a timer annoying? Use a trendy hourglass. Second, incorporate a daily hip flexor stretch like this one. Kneel with your left leg on the floor and right leg at a 90-degree angle in front of you. Put hands on the right knee and keep back straight, keeping left knee on floor. Lean into the right hip while squeezing glute muscles on your left side. Hold for 30 seconds and repeat on the other side. If pain persists or gets worse, see a healthcare provider to rule out joint issues, the expert concludes. Next, pill perplex. Is it safe to take Imodium every day for stomach trouble? She answers, Imodium to treat sudden diarrhea is generally safe, but addressing underlying causes is more effective in the long run, says Joshua Nijnik, PharmD pharmacist and researcher at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Using a drug like Imodium as a preventative on vacation or before an event is appropriate and safe, says the expert. However, keeping a detailed food diary can help uncover highly individualized triggers of distressing gut problems for long-term relief. Other non-drug strategies include eating plain and simple foods, limiting portions, and eating plenty of rice and grains to bulk up gut contents. Walking, mindfulness techniques, and meditation can also help reduce stress symptoms. And while there's not enough evidence to recommend probiotics for everyone with a sensitive stomach, they're worth a try and may help maintain gut health in individual cases, he adds. And finally, from the health section, 5-Minute Fitness, Tai Chi. Build strength and balance with Tai Chi, a gentle workout that combines natural movements with breathing and mental focus. And this is called Touch the Sky. 1, sitting up straight in a chair, place hands in lap with palms facing up. Then, inhale slowly and deeply, raising hands to chest level. 3, turn the palms out and lift your hands above your head, keeping elbows relaxed and slightly bent. 4, exhale slowly, relaxing and lowering arms to sides. Finally, return the hands to the start position. Repetitions? Gradually work up to 10 reps a day, and that was called Touch the Sky. And we'll wrap up with some notes from the pharmacy, tapering PPIs. An earlier column mentioned the importance of de-prescribing, the process of reducing or stopping medications that may no longer be a benefit or may be causing harm. Here's more. Specific reasons for deprescribing can include changes in age, weight, or diet, a new diagnosis, or new side effects. For example, protein pump inhibitors like Prilosec and Prevacid are safe and effective at relieving acid reflux symptoms for up to 60 days. Nevertheless, evidence now suggests that prolonged use carries a range of potential risks, mainly in older adults. Don't quit cold turkey. Rebound hyperacidity can hit hard and fast. Instead, ask your provider if these drugs are still right for you and develop a personalized taper plan if needed. As with any drug, the goal is to take the lowest dose for the shortest amount of time needed for controlling the symptoms. You have been listening to the Saturday Evening Post on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Dick Holt saying goodbye from Owl Radio.